Imagine going to the doctor, right? You're sitting there on that crinkly paper on the exam table.
Oh, yeah, that sound.
Exactly. Everyone knows that sound. So you're sitting there, you get a perfect bill of health, and then you find out later that your body is actually redlining. Like
Yeah.
it's moments away from a catastrophic crash.
Which is terrifying. I mean, usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of, I don't know, almost engineering level precision.
Right. You break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line, and the doctor just points to it and says, "Yep, there it is, broken."
It is a comforting binary. We really have this profound psychological bias toward the visible, right? The localized, the immediate stuff. We want the problem to be a single broken part that we
Yeah.
can just, isolate and fix.
But then you step into the world of cardiovascular health, and suddenly that beautiful, clear x-ray machine is just totally useless.
Completely useless.
We're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is entirely murky. And honestly, that is exactly where we are heading today. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are taking on a massive, fundamentally paradigm-shifting medical policy paper today.
Huge paper.
Yeah, published on April 9, 2026. It's titled "Circulatory Health as a Coherent System, From Developmental Origins to Policy Design" by Dr. Bechara Sakelly.
And we really need to emphasize right off the bat that this is not your standard medical journal article, like at all.
No, the methodology alone is just wild.
It's a fascinating departure from traditional academic writing. I mean, Dr. Sally didn't just sit in a siloed office to write this. He utilized a highly sophisticated suite of AI collaborators to construct this whole theory.
Right.
He used ChatGPT for the massive task of synthesizing incredibly disparate fields. I mean, merging clinical cardiology with urban design and social policy. And then he used Gemini to build out these really complex visual frameworks to map the systems.
And the part I found most intriguing was his use of Notebook LM.
Oh, absolutely.
Because he didn't just use it to organize his notes, right? He used it to run critical adversarial dialogue during the writing process.
Yeah, he essentially built an AI debate partner.
Exactly. To constantly poke holes in his own premises before he published them. Which makes sense because the sheer scale of the problem he's addressing requires that level of stress testing.
The problem completely demanded it because the mission of this paper, and really our mission for you listening right now, is to completely dismantle and reframe how you understand heart disease and, by extension, your own personal
So
health.
we're throwing out the old playbook.
We really are. We're moving entirely away from the concept of health as just this static snapshot of, good lab results. Instead, we are going to explore health as the sustained coherence of a massively complex, interconnected system.
Because the current model is, well, it's quite literally hitting a wall.
A massive wall.
Dr. Sailey opens with this glaring paradox. We have achieved what looks like science fiction levels of advancement in cardiovascular diagnostics, in pharmacotherapy, in interventional surgical care.
Yeah, I mean, we can put tiny stents into microscopic vessels now.
Right. And mortality from massive acute events like heart attacks has dramatically declined in a lot
Yeah.
of parts of the world over the last few decades.
Yet, and here's the catch, the global burden of cardiovascular disease, the chronic grinding conditions like hypertension, heart failure, metabolic syndrome, it just keeps rising exponentially.
It's wild. We possess the sharpest, most technologically advanced tools in human history, but the population is getting sicker.
Exactly. And the paper defines this exact phenomenon as the downstream trap.
Okay, let's unpack this downstream trap because I was really thinking about this when I read the paper. It sounds to me like we're out on the ocean in a sinking boat, right? And we are bailing water out with this highly advanced million-dollar titanium bucket,
A very nice bucket.
the best bucket science can make. But we are completely ignoring the massive gaping hole in the hull where the water's actually rushing in.
What's fascinating here is that your analogy captures the structural flaw in our approach perfectly. Modern cardiovascular care is predominantly organized around what we call secondary and tertiary prevention,
Meaning what exactly?
meaning the medical system essentially waits. It waits for established risk factors to light up on a blood test or for the disease to manifest physically, as a symptom, and only then do we intervene.
So we wait for the boat to start taking on a lot of water.
Right. And by that late stage, the physiological reserve of the body, the hull of your boat, is already severely compromised.
So we intervene late, which means the system requires a massive escalation of medical effort just to temporarily keep the patient's head above water.
Yes, and you see this all the time clinically with conditions like resistant hypertension or advanced heart failure.
Right, the patient ends up on, what, 3, 4, 5 different high-dose medications?
Exactly. Maybe they get a pacemaker, maybe they undergo bypass surgery. We just apply immense medical force.
But the returns on that force diminish rapidly.
Right, very rapidly. Because you only stabilize the system transiently. The blood pressure might drop to a safer number, sure. But you have done absolutely nothing to restore the underlying structural capacity of the hull.
You're just bailing water.
You are just managing the consequences of the leak with an ever more expensive bucket.
So my question is, if we know the hull is leaking, if we know the fundamental structure of the patient's health is degrading over decades, why do our highly sophisticated risk factor models keep ignoring it? Like, why are the smartest doctors in the world hyper-focused on the bucket?
Because the leak is silent. It happens on a timescale that our clinical dashboards are simply not designed to measure.
Interesting.
Yeah. Prevailing diagnostic models are incredibly useful for acute crises, but they are fundamentally fragmented. They lack a system-level organizing principle that connects the leak in the hull to the water in the boat, to the weather outside, to the shipyard where the boat was built.
So they're just looking at the puddle on the deck.
Exactly. And without that overarching framework, our entire multi-trillion dollar health apparatus is structurally blind to the root causes of the disease it is ostensibly trying to fight.
And whether you're, you know, a public health official prepping for a policy meeting, or you're just insanely curious about why standard eat less, move more advice so often feels totally inadequate, this coherence model is going to give you a completely new lens.
It really will change how you view your own body's daily resilience.
But to get there, we first have to completely scrap the old definition of the circulatory system.
Right out the window.
Dr. Sageli argues it is not just a biological plumbing system. It's not just a pump and pipe mechanism.
The plumbing analogy has honestly done massive damage to our understanding of the heart. The paper completely redefines the circulatory system. It calls it a distributed multi-scale adaptive network.
A multi-scale adaptive network.
Yeah. It is an active, deeply intelligent sensing system. It integrates endothelial sensing, which means your blood vessels are literally feeling the physical shear stress of blood flowing through them. Wait, feeling? Like touching?
In a biological sense, yes. They are sensing the chemical composition, the oxygen levels, the inflammatory markers in the blood.
Wow. And it doesn't start there, right? Because that vessel sensing is constantly communicating with your neurohormonal regulation, your immune signaling, your metabolic feedback loops.
Exactly. They are not separate departments in a hospital. They are structurally coupled.
So a change in one area.
Like a change in the chemical makeup of your gut microbiome, for example.
Mm.
That ripples instantaneously into the vascular tone of the arteries in your brain.
That is wild. Everything is talking to everything else.
Constantly. And to map out how this interconnected network actually functions, the paper introduces a framework called the 7 roles viability.
Okay, the 7 roles.
This is the foundational architecture of the coherence system. Rather than just listing them off like a textbook, let's walk through how they operate in a real-world scenario.
Let's do it. I love a good scenario.
Okay, let's take a listener who is having an incredibly stressful morning.
We've all been there. Right. They overslept. They are navigating a brutal, traffic-choked commute. Their boss is just blowing up their phone with aggressive emails.
And maybe they just grabbed a highly processed, you know, sodium bomb breakfast sandwich from a drive-thru because they were running late.
Perfect. So how do the 7 rules play out here? We begin with the first rule, which is constraints.
Constraints.
These are the hard, non-negotiable physiological limits of biology. For our driver, their vessels can only tolerate so much pressure before rupturing.
Like a literal physical limit to the tissue.
Exactly. And their brain requires a minimum threshold of oxygen to remain conscious. You cannot violate constraints without experiencing immediate systemic failure, like a stroke.
Okay, so constraints are basically the outer walls of the system. What is pushing against those walls?
That is the second rule, disturbance. Disturbance is the continuous load placed on the system. So in our driving scenario, the disturbance is multi-layered.
It's the boss's emails.
Yes, the psychological stress, but it's also the environmental stress of the air pollution and traffic. And it's the metabolic load of that massive spike in sodium and refined carbohydrates from the breakfast sandwich.
So the system is under attack from all sides, essentially.
It really is.
But the body has to know it's under attack to do anything about it. Which I'm guessing brings us to how the body actually sees the problem.
Precisely. And that is the third role, perception.
Perception. because the body doesn't have eyes on the inside.
Exactly. It relies on its distributed sensor network. The endothelia in the driver's blood vessels detect that sudden spike in sodium. The brain's amygdala processes the psychological threat of those angry emails.
So the system has to accurately perceive the magnitude of the disturbance to mount a proper response.
Right.
Which means if the perception is skewed-like, if the sensors are blinded or damaged somehow, the rest of the system is essentially flying in the dark.
That is a critical, critical point, and we will definitely return to that later when we talk about distortion. But assuming normal perception for now, the body moves to the fourth role, which is regulation.
Regulation, the autonomic machinery kicking into gear.
Exactly. The sympathetic nervous system fires up. Cortisol and adrenaline flood the bloodstream.
Fight or flight?
Yes. The blood vessels constrict to handle what the body perceives as a crisis, and the kidneys start working overtime to filter out all that extra sodium.
And all of that background regulatory chaos, that invisible effort, results in what a doctor would actually measure when this person eventually sits on the exam table.
Right on the money. That brings us to the fifth role, state.
State.
State is the observable present moment output of the system. It is the blood pressure reading of 140 over 90. It is the resting heart rate of 95 beats per minute.
And this is where the traditional medical model usually stops, right?
Fortunately, yes.
The doctor measures the state, sees that the blood pressure is high, and writes a prescription for a pill to lower it. But what is the system actually sacrificing to maintain that state without hitting the structural constraints we talked about?
That is the million-dollar question. And it brings us to the sixth, and honestly perhaps the most important role in this whole framework, margin.
Margin?
Margin is your reserve capacity. It's your biological buffer zone.
Okay.
It is your metabolic flexibility. It's your microvascular reserve. When our driver's body uses massive regulatory force to keep their blood pressure from blowing past a fatal constraint, it pays for that effort by burning through its margin.
I love this concept. So margin is essentially the health bar in a video game.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, like your character might still be running and fighting on screen. The state looks okay, but your health bar is blinking red in the corner.
Yeah.
You have absolutely nothing left in reserve for the next hit.
That is a perfect translation. You're barely hanging on. And then finally, the seventh role is adaptive options.
Adaptive options. What does that mean? Mm-hmm.
These are the long-term structural adjustments the system can make to try and rebuild that margin or just to cope with chronic disturbance over time.
So changing the actual biology.
Right. So if the blood pressure is always high, the heart muscle might literally thicken, which is called hypertrophy, just to pump harder against those constricted vessels.
Wow.
And behaviorally, the adaptive option might be the driver seeking out alcohol that evening to blunt the stress, which of course then becomes a brand new source of disturbance.
Right. The cycle just feeds itself. So all seven roles, constraints, disturbance, perception, regulation, state, margin, and adaptive options, they form this closed relational loop.
Everything connects to everything.
And health is not about optimizing just one variable, like forcing the state of blood pressure down with a pill. True health is about the harmonious coherence of all these interactions.
Which brings into focus one of the most profound concepts in Dr. Sahili's paper, which is early structural drift.
Okay, this part really blew my mind. Because we are so completely obsessed with measuring the state, you know, that single blood pressure reading on an annual physical, we are entirely blind to early structural drift.
Totally blind.
The idea here is that disease is happening long, long before a clinical test ever shows a problem.
And the paper highlights a specific condition to illustrate this beautifully. Heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, or HSPEF.
HFPES.
Yeah. To a traditional cardiologist, this condition is incredibly frustrating.
Why is that?
Well, the standard metric for heart health is ejection fraction. That's the percentage of blood the heart pumps out with each beat. In HFPEF, the ejection fraction looks perfectly normal. The state appears completely fine.
So the doctor looks at the echocardiogram and says, well, the pump is pumping 60%. You're good to go.
Exactly.
But the patient can barely walk up a single flight of stairs without gasping for air.
Because underneath that normal state, the system's margin has been utterly decimated.
The health bar is blinking red.
Exactly. The microvascular function is severely degraded. The tissues are stiff with systemic low-grade inflammation. The heart is maintaining the necessary output, sure, but the structural cost is immense.
The system has lost its coherence under constraint.
Yes. It is desperately clinging to a normal number on the dash while the underlying architecture just crumbles.
It is exactly like driving a car in second gear on the highway.
Okay, explain that.
So you look at the dashboard, right?
Yeah.
And the speedometer says 65 miles per hour. If the speedometer is your only metric, if that's the only state you measure, you think the car is performing brilliantly.
Doing exactly what it should.
But underneath the hood, the engine is redlining. The RPMs are maxed out, the temperature gauge is pinned, and the engine block is moments away from literally melting down.
Wow, yeah.
You are burning every single drop of your margin just to maintain that illusion of normal speed.
And because our clinical models largely ignore the depletion of margin until it results in catastrophic failure, until the engine melts down, we completely miss the golden window for intervention.
Because it looked fine on paper.
Right. And by the time it doesn't look fine, the system has become increasingly rigid. It's dependent on extreme compensatory mechanisms and stripped of its adaptive flexibility.
So if the definition of disease changes from bad lab results to the loss of underlying margin, how does this fundamentally alter the definition of prevention?
It changes everything.
Because prevention just means checking the speedometer once a year and telling the patient to keep it at 65. We are arguably doing more harm than good.
It forces a total reconceptualization of intervention. And this is where the paper introduces what it calls the prevention gradient.
The prevention gradient.
It maps out a really harsh mathematical reality. As you move later in the life course, from primary prevention to secondary to tertiary, the amount of force required to stabilize a patient increases exponentially.
Right.
But the reversibility of the underlying disease plummets to near zero.
Because the hull is already gone.
Exactly. You are applying high-force pharmaceuticals and invasive surgeries for extremely low structural reversibility.
So what's the alternative?
To counter this, Dr. Sahili borrows a principle from Taoist philosophy and complex systems theory. It's called Wu Wei.
Okay, Wu Wei. Often translated as non-action or effortless action, right?
That's the one.
How on earth does ancient Chinese philosophy apply to modern clinical cardiology?
Well, in this context, Wu Wei does not mean doing nothing.
Okay.
It means minimal force intervention applied at the point of highest leverage.
I see.
It is about deeply understanding the flow of the coherence system and acting early. Acting when the system still possesses abundant margin.
When the health bar is full.
Yes. So that incredibly small, highly aligned adjustments can preserve the system's capacity rather than consuming it. It is the art of shaping the conditions of health so that massive medical force simply never becomes necessary in the first place.
Which naturally begs the question, right? If true cardiovascular health is entirely dependent on maintaining this margin, this deep physiological buffer against all the chaos of life, where does that margin actually come from?
Right. How do we get it?
Yeah. How do I get more of it? And the paper takes us on a really fascinating chronological journey to answer that. It takes us all the way back to the very beginning of life.
This is honestly where the synthesis of the paper really shines, because it integrates developmental biology, specifically something called the Developmental Origins of Health and Disease, or DOHED.
DOHED.
Yeah. This framework establishes that your fundamental physiological baseline, the sheer size of the hull of your boat, is actually constructed in the prenatal environment and during early childhood.
Wait, we are talking about the environment you existed in before you even took your first breath.
We are. During embryonic and early childhood development, biological systems are incredibly plastic.
Meaning they can change easily.
Right. They are rapidly building themselves, and they are highly, highly sensitive to the environmental signals they receive.
What kind of signals?
Well, organ formation, the literal architecture and density of your vascular network, the total number of nephrons in your kidneys, which will filter your blood for the rest of your life, the baseline calibration of your metabolic and autonomic regulation. All of this is structurally cemented during this really brief window.
So if a baby is developing in a womb that's exposed to highly adverse conditions,
like severe maternal psychological stress or undernutrition,
right, or even exposure to environmental toxicity like heavy metals or extreme air pollution.
Yes.
The body doesn't just momentarily suffer, right? It literally constructs itself differently based on those signals.
That is the absolute core mechanism of DOHAD. The developing system uses epigenetic modifications.
Epigenetics.
Yeah. These early exposures actually alter the expression of genes without changing the underlying DNA sequence itself.
So the code is the same, but how it's read changes.
Exactly. If the prenatal environment is signaling chronic stress or scarcity, the fetal system makes an adaptive choice.
It's trying to survive.
Right. It assumes the outside world is going to be dangerous and resource poor, so the baby might be born with a reduced number of filtering units in their kidneys. Their neuroendocrine system might be permanently calibrated to be hyperreactive to stress.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because I want to pause here. This is heavy.
It is.
If the foundational architecture of my cardiovascular margin, like my ability to handle stress and process food, was permanently set before I could even walk.
Yeah.
Isn't that incredibly fatalistic?
It feels that way. Yeah.
Doesn't this imply that if you just drew a bad hand in the womb, your biology is basically a ticking time bomb and there's nothing you can do about it?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is a sobering realization, absolutely, but it is not entirely deterministic. Okay. It is about baseline vulnerability. A system built with less structural margin and a hypersensitive stress response will simply experience a dramatically higher effective load from the exact same daily stressors as someone built with a massive margin.
So it's relative.
Yes. Two adults can eat the exact same meal. They can experience the exact same stressful meeting at work. But the biological wear and tear, the structural drift we talked about, will be vastly accelerated in the person with compromised developmental origins.
It really is like starting a video game on hard mode.
Completely.
With half your health bar permanently depleted from the start, every minor hit does critical damage.
That's exactly it.
Which implies that prenatal care and early childhood interventions are not just, you know, nice, warm and fuzzy social programs. They are, quite literally, the most potent cardiovascular medicines we possess.
They are primordial prevention, securing maternal health, ensuring adequate prenatal nutrition, and creating stable, toxin-free early childhood environments.
Yeah.
These are the only ways to build a robust structural hull.
But our medical system barely treats maternal health as a cardiovascular issue at all.
No, it doesn't.
We treat it as a separate silo. It's a completely different department in the hospital.
And that is the tragedy of short-term incentives in healthcare. We ignore primordial prevention because the return on investment takes 4 to 5 decades to appear on a balance sheet.
Right. The CEO of the hospital is long gone by then.
Exactly. The financial benefits are massively delayed and distributed across society, while the costs of the interventions are immediate.
Hmm.
But Dr. Savely's system logic here is brutal.
Oh, how so?
Failing to fiercely protect the developmental environment mathematically guarantees an infinite escalation of downstream medical demand.
Because you are mass-producing leaky boats.
You are mass-producing leaky boats and then acting surprised when they sink.
Wow. Okay, so the baseline structural margin is built in the womb and in early childhood. But obviously, life doesn't stop at age 5.
Usually not.
You have to take that baseline, whatever it is, and walk out into the adult world. How does our daily life either protect that precious reserve or relentlessly drain it? Which brings us to the continuous pressures of the social environment.
The social determinants of health.
Yeah.
Historically, medicine has viewed things like housing quality, work conditions, income security, and education as background variables. You know, just static demographic data points on a chart.
Like, check this box if you make under this amount.
Right. But the coherence framework demands we view them completely differently. Dr. Saheli argues these are not intermittent background factors. They are the continuous active context regulating the biological reserve of your system every second of your life.
The continuous context, meaning it never switches off.
Never.
It is the water the fish is swimming in.
Exactly. Favorable social conditions, secure housing, reliable income, community cohesion, supportive occupational environments, they provide a massive biological buffer.
They protect the margin.
Yes. They promote autonomic balance, allowing the parasympathetic nervous system to actually initiate recovery and preserve margin. But adverse conditions function as a continuous high voltage drain on the system.
Let's trace the biology of that, actually.
Yeah.
Because I think people hear stress and think of it as just an emotion. How does the stress of, say, not being able to pay rent literally translate into arterial plaque?
It's a very direct pathway.
The text mentions that chronic financial insecurity, or living in a neighborhood constantly threatened by violence, translates into the sustained, relentless activation of the body's stress pathways.
The biological translation is profound. When you are under chronic occupational strain or housing insecurity, your amygdala, the fear center of your brain, is constantly firing threat signals.
Constant alarm.
Constant. Your baseline cortisol and adrenaline levels remain elevated. And this sustained neurohormonal flood directly damages the endothelial lining of your blood vessels.
It physically damages the tissue.
Yes. It triggers systemic low-grade inflammation. your metabolic pathways become insulin resistant.
Because your body thinks it is running from a tiger, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for decades.
You're in perpetual survival mode. And that daily inescapable strain dramatically increases your baseline allostatic load.
Yeah.
Your regulatory efficiency just plummets.
So what happens to the whole system then?
Your system becomes brittle. It becomes significantly slower to recover from acute stressors, like an infection or a sudden physical exertion, and it becomes vastly more vulnerable to catastrophic failure.
This framing utterly destroys the classic, you know, rugged individualist medical advice.
No, it dismantles it completely.
It's like trying to run a marathon, but some people are given a smooth, perfectly paved track with water stations every single mile.
Right.
And others are forced to run through a waist-deep swamp wearing a 50-pound weighted vest while being chased by dogs.
A brutal marathon.
Yeah. And yet the traditional clinical approach is to stand at the finish line, look at the people emerging from the swamp covered in mud and completely exhausted, and yell at them to just run faster or to make better choices.
It exposes the profound inadequacy of purely behavioral interventions. And actually, it is crucial to highlight here that Dr. Saley does not make this point as some kind of political or moral judgment.
Right. It's not about politics.
Exactly. The paper analyzes social determinants strictly through the lens of system efficiency and mathematical coherence.
Which means what, practically, for the listener?
It means that individual behavior change is biologically and structurally constrained by the environment.
Okay, give me an example.
When harmful high-load options like cheap, hyper-palatable, ultra-processed food are ubiquitously available, heavily marketed, and culturally normalized.
Which they are everywhere.
Right. And simultaneously, healthy, low-load options are expensive, require immense time to prepare, or are geographically inaccessible in food deserts.
Then the system's adaptive options are structurally rigged.
Exactly. The choices aren't really choices at all. They are the path of least biological and economic resistance.
Wow. The path of least resistance.
Precisely. The behavioral patterns we observe in populations, you know, high rates of smoking, poor diet, sedentary lifestyles, they are very often a logical, biological reflection of system design, not simply a failure of individual willpower.
That is a massive shift in perspective.
It is. The paper argues that the massive health inequality we see across socioeconomic lines isn't just an unfortunate statistical reality.
What is it then?
It is a manifestation of structural divergence. It is a blazing red warning light on the dashboard of our civilization, indicating deep, deep systemic instability.
Telling a patient to make better choices without altering the environment they are forced to choose within is, from a systems engineering perspective, a guaranteed failure.
100%.
But I want to push back a bit here, or rather, I want to dig into an even darker layer of this.
Okay, let's go there.
Because what we just described, poverty, bad housing, stressful jobs, that feels like the environment is just passively difficult.
Right.
A lack of resources.
Just a hard situation, yeah.
But the paper doesn't stop there. It argues there are active, incredibly well-funded structural forces intentionally accelerating the drain on our biological margin. We are talking about the commercial determinants of health.
Yes. This is where the paper shifts from analyzing natural biological vulnerability to examining engineered biological extraction.
Engineered extraction.
Huh.
Like mining our health.
Exactly like that. The commercial determinants include industries like ultra-processed foods, tobacco and vaping, digital platforms optimized for algorithmic addiction, and built environments engineered entirely around the automobile.
Okay.
The paper defines these not merely as risk factors, but as organized, highly capitalized pathways designed to systematically inject physiological disturbance into the human coherence system.
For profit.
Organized pathways of disturbance. That sounds, honestly, almost conspiratorial. Are we really saying that corporations are intentionally designing products to destroy our blood vessels?
It is not a conspiracy. It is the natural, predictable outcome of unconstrained market incentives.
How so? Well, these industries are optimized for one metric and one metric only: quarterly profit and shareholder return.
Right.
To achieve infinite growth, they must capture and consume human attention, biology, and behavior. Highly processed foods, for instance, are chemically engineered by food scientists to bypass satiety signals and promote hyperconsumption.
So you literally can't eat just one.
Exactly. And that drives massive metabolic dysregulation.
And on the tech side, addictive digital platforms disrupt our circadian rhythms, they elevate chronic stress, and obliterate our sleep architecture.
Which directly degrades cardiovascular recovery.
Right. And our built environments, our cities, literally engineer physical activity out of our daily life to maximize the efficiency of commerce and fossil fuel consumption.
Every single one of these commercial forces artificially increases our baseline biological load and rapidly, ruthlessly depletes our finite margin.
But here is the absolute most mind-bending concept in the entire paper for me. And I want to spend some real time on this.
Okay.
It's the concept of the distortion field.
Oh, this is brilliant.
It is not just that these commercial forces are pumping disturbance into our biology. It is that they are actively, intentionally blinding us to the fact that we are being harmed.
The concept of the distortion field ties back beautifully to our earlier discussion of the seven roles of viability.
The sensors.
Yes. Remember the role of perception.
Right. How the body sees the threat.
The body and the conscious mind must accurately perceive the internal state and the external threat to regulate the system effectively.
Right. If your hand touches a hot stove, your pain receptors must accurately send a signal of damage so you pull your hand away.
But what if the stove is designed to feel like a massage while it burns you?
Oh, man.
That is the essence of the distortion field. The paper argues that commercial forces use their massive capital advantage to intentionally distort our perception.
So they mess with the signal.
Distortion is mathematically defined in the text as the divergence between the actual biological state of the system and the state as it is perceived by individuals, cultures, and policymakers.
How exactly do they pull off this distortion, though? I know Notebook LM was heavily used in the drafting of this specific section to aggressively debate the mechanics of this blinding effect.
Yeah, the AI adversarial dialogue likely helped refine the realization that distortion isn't just lying, you know, it is narrative capture.
Narrative capture.
These industries utilize relentless marketing, complex incentive structures, and heavily funded lobbying to alter the informational environment. They actively attenuate the biological warning signals.
Can you give me a historical parallel to make this concrete for people?
The most glaring historical example is the 20th century tobacco industry.
Oh, of course.
For decades, the actual biological state of a smoker system was one of massive, compounding cellular damage and cardiovascular destruction.
Lungs turning black.
Right. But the perceived system state, which was meticulously crafted by billion-dollar advertising campaigns, physician endorsements, and cultural product placement, was one of sophistication, relaxation, stress relief.
And perfectly normalized adult behavior.
Exactly. The public's recognition of the severe harm was artificially delayed for over half a century through active distortion.
And we are seeing the exact same playbook today.
We really are.
I look at my social media feed, and the consumption of ultra-processed, hyper-palatable food is aggressively framed as an issue of personal freedom or a fun treat.
Treat yourself.
Right. Or, when the health consequences inevitably arise, it's framed as a strict failure of personal caloric mathematics and willpower.
You just didn't try hard enough.
Yeah, it is almost never framed as what it biologically is.
Yeah.
A massive, unavoidable structural exposure to an engineered metabolic toxin.
To take that a step further, the distortion field is so powerful that it even captures the medical profession itself.
Oh, definitely.
Doctors are often taught to treat the metabolic fallout of these diets with pharmaceuticals, rather than advocating for the regulation of the food environment itself.
So the market profits on the front end by injecting the biological disturbance.
And the pharmaceutical industry profits on the back end by managing the chronic symptoms.
So what does this all mean? We're essentially saying the human coherent system is being steadily poisoned, and the poison is sold with a pair of highly sophisticated blinders.
Yes.
If the distortion field weakens our early warning signals, how do we possibly fight back? I mean, you can't just hand someone a pamphlet on nutrition and expect them to overcome a billion-dollar behavioral engineering apparatus.
The paper makes exactly that point. Traditional public health campaigns relying on information and education are completely insufficient.
The drop in the bucket.
You cannot educate your way out of a distortion field that outspends you 10,000 to 1.
So what's the move?
A true coherence-based approach requires aggressive regulatory measures. It requires breaking the information asymmetry.
Okay.
We have to change the economic structures that allow corporations to privatize short-term financial gains while completely externalizing the massive long-term health costs onto the public taxpayer.
And the crumbling hospital system.
Exactly. Which brings us to the highest level of this entire framework, governance.
Section 5 of the paper.
Right. It deals with health in all policies, or high AP.
If our biology is shaped by the womb, drained by social environments, and actively exploited by commercial distortion, then cardiovascular health cannot simply be the job of cardiologists.
It's way too big for them.
Right. It is fundamentally a massive governance and urban planning issue.
It is the ultimate systems-level realization. Dr. Solly details the concept of cross-sectoral divergence.
A cross-sectoral divergence.
Right now, our government functions in isolated silos. The Department of Transportation might prioritize expanding multi-lane highways to improve car commuting speeds,
which actively engineers walking and cycling right out of the community.
Exactly. While simultaneously, the Department of Agriculture is heavily subsidizing the monocrop farming of corn and soy,
artificially driving down the cost of the exact ingredients used to manufacture ultra-processed foods.
You see how it connects. And then years later, the Department of Health and Human Services is left staring at a skyrocketing budget, trying to figure out why rates of obesity, diabetes, and heart failure are exploding.
The left hand of government policy is systematically stabbing the right hand, and the right hand is just begging for more bandages.
A perfect summary.
This cross-sector divergence seems so painfully obvious when you say it out loud, but why is it so hard for policymakers to detect and correct in real time?
Because of how we define and measure success.
The metrics are wrong.
The paper provides a brilliant, clarifying visual contrast between what it calls dashboard metrics and a structural altimeter.
Let's break that down.
Currently, global health policy is entirely captured by dashboard metrics. These are things like average blood pressure in a population, acute myocardial infarction hospitalization rates, or all-cause mortality statistics.
But as we established earlier with the redlining car, those are lagging indicators.
They lag by decades.
Right. By the time a population's mortality rate goes up, the systemic damage has been accumulating for, what, 30, 40 years? The system has already crashed.
Precisely. To govern a coherent system, Dr. Salhiel proposes replacing the dashboard with a structural altimeter.
An altimeter
doesn't measure crashes. It measures dynamic altitude and trajectory. In public health, a structural altimeter would monitor leading indicators of system coherence.
What does that actually look like? Like, what data points are on an altimeter?
It would measure the physiological variability across different zip codes. For one,
okay.
It would measure the recovery time of a community's collective health metrics after an economic shock or a natural disaster.
Seeing how fast they bounce back.
Right. It would track the degree of cross-sector policy alignment, like, is the transportation budget actively supporting the health budget? And crucially, it would measure the sheer volume of medical intervention effort required merely to maintain the status quo.
Wow. It is the difference between counting the death toll of plane crashes, which is the dashboard, versus placing sensitive monitors on the wings of the plane to detect micro vibrations and metal fatigue while the plane is still flying.
Exactly.
You want to know the wing is fatiguing years before it actually snaps off in midair.
Much better strategy.
But let's bring this down to earth for a second. I want to push on how a city planner actually uses a health altimeter in the real world, like tomorrow.
The text utilizes urban design as the perfect tangible example of this theory in action. Consider the planning of walkable cities.
Okay.
The integration of extensive green spaces and zoning for mixed land use so people actually live near their grocery stores and workplaces.
Now, from a traditional dashboard perspective, those look like aesthetic choices, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe environmental green initiatives.
Right, nice to haves. But through the lens of the coherence altimeter, designing a walkable city is a profound, low-force, highly aligned biological intervention.
Because it targets the margin.
Yes. By organically embedding physical movement into the daily fabric of life, you lower the baseline physiological load across the entire population.
You reduce chronic cortisol by separating humans from high-stress traffic commutes.
You decrease air pollution exposure, which preserves endothelial function.
You don't have to rely on an individual summoning the Herculean willpower to drive to a gym after a grueling 10-hour workday.
Nobody wants to do that.
No. The physical activity just happened seamlessly because they walked a mile to safely drop their kid off at school and grab groceries.
Exactly. The environment itself does the heavy lifting of regulation rather than forcing the individual's biology to do it. The altimeter measures whether we are designing physical and social architectures that reduce the total adaptive effort required by the human body to maintain stability.
Which really represents the ultimate pivot in this entire framework. We are talking about completely shifting our societal focus from obsessively fighting disease to actively generating health.
That is the turning point.
This brings us to the final major concept of the paper. the salutogenic model and condition design.
Salutogenesis, it is a term that honestly needs to be shouted from the rooftops of every medical school.
That's the opposite of pathogenesis, right?
It is the exact antithesis. Pathogenesis asks, what causes this specific disease, and what chemical can I use to block it?
A bucket.
Right. Salutogenesis asks a fundamentally different question. What are the structural conditions that actively create and sustain health and adaptability over an entire lifespan?
And the paper doesn't just offer this as some vague philosophy. It actually provides a conceptual mathematical equation to define it.
It does.
It states that health is roughly equal to your reserve multiplied by your adaptive alignment, all divided by your load multiplied by distortion.
Let's spend some real time breaking down the mechanics of that equation because it beautifully synthesizes everything we've discussed today.
Yeah, let's look at the top half first, the numerator.
The numerator represents the forces that generate stability. Reserve is that deep structural margin built during your developmental origins.
In the womb.
Yes, and protected by social stability later on. And adaptive alignment means your body's regulatory responses are correctly matched to the reality of the environment.
So as long as the top half of that equation, reserve and alignment, remains large and robust, your overall health stays high.
Exactly. But conversely, look at the denominator, the bottom half of the equation.
Right.
This represents the forces pulling the system toward collapse. Load is the aggregate weight of daily disturbances. The ultra-processed diet, the financial stress, the environmental toxins.
And crucially, that load is multiplied by distortion, the commercial and cultural forces that blind you to the damage being done.
Which means, mathematically, if the distortion factor is incredibly high, like if society completely normalizes a toxic environment, it exponentially magnifies the destructive impact of the load because no one takes any action to reduce it.
They don't even see it.
Right. And when the denominator grows larger than the numerator, when load and distortion overwhelm reserve and alignment, the coherence system fractures.
Disease emerges.
I love the math. It makes profound intuitive sense. It makes the invisible dynamics of chronic illness completely visible.
It proves that health isn't a static number. It is an active, precarious balance between opposing structural forces.
But I have to play devil's advocate here regarding implementation.
Go for it. Translating this beautiful, theoretical, salutogenic equation into our current, deeply entrenched medical-industrial complex seems bordering on impossible.
It is a monumental task.
I mean, our doctors are heavily incentivized and reimbursed solely for treating late-stage symptoms.
Mm.
A hospital makes millions of dollars performing advanced bypass surgeries and prescribing lifetime regimens of beta blockers.
That's the business model.
A doctor literally cannot bill an insurance company for advocating for a walkable city or prescribing a reduction in commercial distortion.
Your skepticism is entirely warranted. And honestly, Dr. Sakely explicitly acknowledges these immense implementation barriers in the text.
He knows it's an uphill battle.
Oh, absolutely. Institutional silos, deeply ingrained cultural biases toward visible, heroic technological interventions.
Shiny tools.
Right. And the overwhelming financial momentum of the pharmaceutical and procedural industries. They all stand directly in the way of this paradigm shift.
It feels like an immovable object. So how does he justify the effort to even try?
This raises an important question, and he justifies it by forcing us to look at the terrifying alternative.
Nice.
The paper raises an unavoidable mathematical reality. Continuing exactly as we are guarantees the eventual catastrophic collapse of global health system.
They will just break.
We are facing infinite, exponentially escalating demand for highly complex, wildly expensive downstream care, while the fundamental biological resilience of the population completely collapses.
The engine melts down.
We physically, economically, and biologically cannot afford to keep bailing water with a $1 million bucket while the hole in the hull gets exponentially larger.
So what is the actual way out? If the current system is doomed by its own success, what are the alternatives?
The only viable way forward is what Dr. Sakely terms condition design.
Condition design.
We must elevate our perspective. We have to shift massive amounts of capital and intellectual focus away from managing end-stage disease within a toxic environment and instead actively shape the physical, social, and commercial conditions in which human biology unfolds.
We have to stop bailing water and fix the hull of the boat.
We have to fix the hull and we have to calm the waters we sail in.
Wow.
It demands radical cross-sector coordination, aligning corporate and political incentives with long-term biological outcomes, and practicing the art of wu-wei minimal force, high-leverage intervention at the very beginning of the life course.
Because health is not, and never has been, produced by the sheer force of medical intervention.
Never. True health is an emergent property. It is produced by the coherence of the conditions in which life is lived.
Produced by the coherence of the conditions.
Yeah.
That is incredibly powerful.
It really is.
Let's bring this massive journey all together. We have covered an astonishing amount of ground today.
We definitely have.
We started at the microscopic cellular level of a fetus developing in the womb, exploring how our fundamental biological margin is permanently constructed.
And then we tracked how that biological reserve is carried out into the world, right? Where it is subjected to the continuous grinding context of social determinants. How poverty, stress, and environment systematically drain that margin.
We examined the profound threat of the distortion field. How massive commercial interests actively engineer environments that inject biological disturbance into our bodies while simultaneously blinding us to the damage through narrative capture and marketing.
We explored the absolute necessity of breaking down fragmented governance, realizing that transportation, agriculture, and urban planning are actually the most potent forms of public health policy we have.
And the need to replace our lagging clinical dashboards with a dynamic, forward-looking structural altimeter.
And finally, we unpacked the salutogenic equation, proving that we must shift our entire civilization's focus from frantically managing the symptoms of disease to actively designing the conditions that generate resilient health.
So for everyone listening to this right now, I want to challenge you to evaluate your own life and the environment around you using this completely new lens. Are you living your life by the dashboard or the altimeter?
That's the question.
Are you just passively waiting for your annual physical, hoping your blood pressure reading tells you that you are okay? Or are you starting to notice the subtle dynamic indicators of your own coherence?
Right.
How long does it actually take you to biologically and psychologically recover from a stressful week at work? How much of your finite, precious reserve is being silently drained by the physical and digital environments you occupy every single day?
It requires a profound and sometimes uncomfortable shift in personal perspective. It means recognizing that your individual health is not simply a product of your genetics or how many times you managed to force yourself onto the treadmill this week. Your health is the continuous emergent property of your environment.
Exactly. And I want to leave you with one final, deeply provocative thought built on everything we've discussed from this text.
Let's hear it.
If our internal physiological health is fundamentally a direct reflection of our external policy, social, and commercial environment, then perhaps the ultimate vital sign we should be monitoring isn't our resting heart rate or our cholesterol levels at all.
Right.
Perhaps the ultimate vital sign is the structural health of our communities. If you were a doctor, fully armed with this coherence framework, and you were asked to diagnose your city's coherence system today, what prescription would you write first?
That is the exact question every single policymaker should be forced to answer.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep exploring, keep aggressively questioning the design of the systems around you, and remember, do not wait for the X-ray to tell you the system is broken. Learn to look at the murky waters. See you next time.